Claire will be bringing the message for us this morning. And before the message, we were reading from Isaiah chapter 6. And this is Isaiah speaking, Isaiah sharing, and he tells what year it is. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord, high and exalted, seated on the throne, and a train of his robe filled the temple. Can you imagine that sight, that image, that vision? Above him were seraphim, each with six wings, which two wings they covered their faces, which two wings they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. "Woe to me," I cried. "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. And my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it, he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And I said, "Here I am, send me." Blessings, Claire, as you share with us.
Well, good morning, everybody. So this morning we're going to be spending a bit of time asking one of those puzzling questions that I don't know that they might ask in psychology class or philosophy, or I'm not sure where all this could be asked, but it's really a pretty human question. Who am I? And how do I know I am who I am? And all those existential questions. What I want us to do this morning is just to kind of sit back and think about how much time we actually spend thinking about ourselves. Because we do it all the time. We're very, very, and we use the word self-conscious as if it's kind of like a kind of a weakness. But it's something that is just part of human experience. We're very conscious of ourselves. So we have all these things that we identify with that help us to kind of define who we are. And so we have a lot of thought space invested in identifying with things. Whether it be identifying, what family am I a part of, and all the things that relates to my hometown, my alma mater, a myriad of social, religious, political groupings I might see myself as a part of. We identify with our body, issues of beauty, health, gender. We identify with our accomplishments or our abilities or our lack of abilities. We identify with our career. You get in a group of strangers. For me, as a man, it's like you're trying to figure each other out. The first couple questions is, where are you from and what do you do for a living, right? It's like, well, who's your family? Or, you know, all those, you know, where do you go to church? These are things that really are pointing to kind of the ways that we identify ourselves. Also, we identify heavily with beliefs, ideas, being right, what I'm for or what I'm against. We identify with interests, hobbies, skills. We identify with things and possessions. We identify with the past, or some of us spend more time identifying with the future. So, I think probably depending on personality and life experiences, we tend to favor one or some of those more than others. But really they all can kind of be that voice in our head, and we identify with it regardless of how reductionistic it is, regardless of how demeaning it is, whether it says we're great or worthless, whether it's conflated or self-congratulating. We listen to it all the time, and it's going along in our heads. And the interesting thing is that, you know, even just kind of the self-image of whether we see ourselves as worthless or better than others, those are about this far apart, I think, for most of us. So what we're really talking about is a central function of the human psyche that many psychologists call the ego. And again, we use the ego generally in a very derogatory way, or that person is egocentric or whatever. But I don't want us to think about the ego as just simply arrogance today. The way that I like to use it is more like a summation of all of our thoughts about ourselves. And how we experience being conscious of ourselves and that voice in our head, our inner talk, those things that just go through our mind all day long. So just consider for a moment how many of your waking thoughts are indeed self-conscious. You're thinking about yourself. It's just pretty constant. If you're anything like me, when we have the moment of silence here and we light the peace lamp and we might be still and quiet for 30 seconds or a minute, that's usually about just enough for me to realize that my thoughts are racing, and I can't do anything about it. Maybe some of you can quickly come to quietness. And I really appreciate this tradition, by the way. But it's kind of like I've just been, you know, all morning long or all week long. And have I had time to even stop thinking, or to even, I guess I'm jumping ahead of myself, but I like to contrast this with just listening to the Spirit. So if this thing is going 24/7, 365, how can we ever be at a place where we can listen to the Spirit? Some would call the ego the false self, or simply who you think you are. It's a social mental construct, and it's self-fabricated. We make it up ourselves, what we think of ourselves. Why would they call it the false self? So just kind of a hypothetical scenario to help you out here. What if I identify myself primarily by my achievements? I'm a doer. I'm a very accomplished person. I have a solid career that's, just doing great. My ability to make stuff happen and get things done. What if I then have a life-altering accident where I'm left paralyzed from the neck down, unable to even feed myself? Is Claire suddenly no longer Claire? People with disabilities can see through that kind of rubbish pretty quickly, because they realize that they're not what they're able to do. They're something else, something deeper than that. What if I identify primarily with things, and I lose it all in a devastating fire or flood? Am I no longer me after I've lost all my things? What if I'm a famous pianist and lose function in my fingers? What if I'm simply aging and I can't do the things I used to do? Has who I am really changed or disappeared? Who am I regardless of all these things? Am I merely a sum total of my rationalizations, my mental assents or oppositions, or the thing that my mind attaches itself to for meaning and identity? In a little bit, we're going to look at some biblical examples, but just right off, I want to point out the story of Job, because I think that the story of Job is really the story about a man who lost it all and tangled with God about his ego. What is the point of all this after I've lost it all? And I think we can look at the story of Job and we can use that to help us make sense of the crises that all of us face. Most of you in this room are a lot older than me, so you have a good chance of knowing a lot more about this than I do. But crises have a way of sitting us down in our chair and all of a sudden realizing what's more important than what's been going through my head for the last decade or more, or the last week. And sometimes those crises just leave us kind of flailing. We don't know what to grab onto. We feel like we're in a free fall. And because everything that the ego had identified with is gone. And this is what many people experience in what they call a midlife crisis. You know, it's like everything you worked so hard to build in the first half of your life, you suddenly have to start leaving go of, and you don't know how to do it. So I think Job is a powerful story. And maybe after having said that, you just want to take another look at Job and read it in that light. So we go to all ends to fabricate a story in our heads about who we are. And I think there's even a new phenomenon in our time, and that is in human history, and that is social media and the internet. You know, it's like not only do we have this natural inclination to identify with all these things, but now we can curate, our content is curated for us through internet search engines, and we can kind of develop our own persona that we want to have on social media platforms. And kind of have the friends we want and kind of build that whole, like, identity in a virtual way. So it's a very new thing, and I think it these things become so much more important to understand, about ourselves. So, but before we give ego too bad of a rap, I really want to point out its important role in human development, because I think that hating on the ego is not really going to get us anywhere in our spiritual formation and learning to follow the Spirit. I'll talk more about that in a little bit. But it is super important for this to be developed in children and teenagers. I mean, this is a time in life when they're starting to differentiate from their parents. They're starting to become aware of themselves. If you have a young child that doesn't develop the ego, they will constantly hurt themselves because they don't know how to take care of themselves. It's almost like a survival mechanism. You kind of think about yourself in a way that you think ahead, and then you use that executive function to make a decision and say, well, no, I'm not going to jump out of the tree because that will sprain my ankle. It's just an important part of that development. Also for young children and young adults to start to think for themselves. None of us would want our children to grow up to not be able to think for themselves. But yet we have a hard time letting them think for themselves and making decisions. It's a very difficult transition for us as parents to let go of that, and to let them do that. But that is an important part of the development of the ego. If they can't think for themselves, neither will they be able to differentiate from their peers and think for themselves in that context. It's kind of all one package for us as human beings is what I'm saying. It even though we're, the whole self-conscious thing can take us down, pretty dark paths, it is an important part of who we are otherwise we couldn't function. One of the books that would have inspired some of these thoughts is a book I read a number of years ago now by Jill Bolt called The Stroke of Insight, My Stroke of Insight. I don't know, have any of you read the book? I think she's a neuroscientist that had a stroke and for a time was completely, had lost function in her left brain. And so, just no executive function whatsoever, wasn't able to, string together pieces of thoughts, to be able to take care of herself. And that's really, a part of the ego as well. But in her experiences, she realized how much that side kind of suppressed and silenced the whole other side of what it means to be a person. So, great book recommendation. Did I see you raise your hand? You liked it? Yeah, I thought it was a great book. So the function of the ego will never go away for us as people, but its enduring nature in our human experience absolutely requires us to pay attention to spiritual formation and spiritual disciplines to recognize it for what it is and to respond to it appropriately as we grow older. Because unrecognized and left to its own devices, it is an absolute trickster and an imposter, and it's the number one gatekeeper and roadblock on the lifetime path of transformation. It will keep us from where we want to go in following Christ. So I have a little bunny trail here, and I hope... No, I won't say that. I was going to say... Now I have to say it. I was going to say, I hope it's not offensive. but I wonder sometimes if we even look to Jesus as a spiritual teacher or guide. In Judaism, they have their rabbis, and in Buddhism and Hinduism, Islam, and many other religions, they have spiritual teachers and gurus. And sometimes I get the sense that in Christianity, it's like we have this leader Jesus whose only purpose was to atone for our sin, and so therefore we follow him. I just have a question. Would you be attracted to the teachings of Jesus if it had nothing to do with your eternal destiny? Or would you think, this guy's just nuts? You know, because he said some pretty crazy stuff. And I challenge you to read the scriptures in light of just looking at his teachings kind of as a standalone, and just saying, what is he trying to teach us as human beings? And kind of look to Jesus as a wisdom teacher. And I'm not saying that's the only way we should look at him. I'm saying that as an exercise, it might be helpful for us to start to look at his teachings and say, he is speaking to the human condition and the human experience, and what do I need to learn about this to take the next step in my spiritual transformation, and to become more like him, or more like God. So just a couple things. No, I think we're going to come back to this. Specifically some things that he teaches. But I think we're going to skip over that right now. And instead, we're going to just look at what some folks call what's called a theophany, or like in the scriptures when there's a story of a person who has an encounter with God or an angel, called a theophany. And looking at some patterns of what happens when those folks had a theophany. So Isaiah, in our scripture passage, saw the glory of the Lord, and it just put him on his knees, and he said, woe is me. And I think you see that kind of as a pattern many times when a person encounters the divine or an angel. It's woe is me, just a feeling of undoneness, exposure. What other words could be used to describe it? A lot of times fear. And the first thing that often comes in response to that is, fear not, or take courage. I just find that so fascinating, because I think what's happening in those theophanies, and you can look at all of them through the scriptures, for a quick list here, even Adam and Eve as an example, Gideon, Moses, Isaiah, Jacob, Joshua, Balaam, Zechariah, Mary, the mother of Jesus, and many other encounters of people with Jesus in his life. It seems to me that those times there was just a moment of clarity when they saw perfectly well that who they thought of themselves to be just didn't really matter. And all of a sudden, all they had was just who they really were. And they felt very small and kind of exposed or undone in that moment. Like, because the ego is a master of charades and play acting. But then God's response to that is beautiful too. It's more like a holding the hand and lifting up and take courage, don't be afraid, because you actually are something. But maybe not what you thought you were, not the names that you gave yourself. Those don't mean anything. But you do have a name, and I want you to do this. So that was, you know, the story there with Isaiah. I'm a man of unclean lips, and God says to him, well, use those lips for me. Individuals in the Bible who had mystical encounters with God were undone and often afraid. And I think that any time our ego is exposed for what it is, it can be a terrifying experience. I don't even think I have to really tell you the times in your life when you just really didn't want people to know a certain thing about you, because it would have been just terrifying. That's about as simple as it gets. But one of the greatest lies that we believe is that we could never survive without all the well-developed ways we have come to think about ourselves. And I'm going to say that again, because it just, for me, it's just so difficult for me to actually do this in my life. One of the greatest lies we believe is that we could never survive without all the well-developed ways we have come to think about ourselves. It's really hard for me sometimes to imagine certain pictures of my life just dropping out. You know, what would I even be or do or feel or connect with or find meaning in if this or that or the other thing would just drop out of my life or be lost? Jesus said, to find your life, you need to lose it. And I think that is one of the most powerful little phrases in all of his teachings. And I don't really know how to do it, but I think I'm starting to understand what it might mean. And I don't think that we can really figure it out at any one stop in our life. I think at 20, and at 30, and at 40, and at 60, and at 80, it's going to look different for each of us. And I think this is why conversions that touch only on moral behaviors can leave a person with an even stronger and more solidified ego than they had before. We've all heard about Jonathan Edwards' famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And I think about, you know, a different time period, obviously, and all the ways that I don't understand how those people thought. But I just wonder how many folks, converts, hearing a sermon like that, a year later had an even stronger ego than they had the year before. Just because now they had gotten this right, and now I have an even stronger understanding of who I am, an attachment, an identity about what I am and what I can do, or things that I don't do anymore. But I'd like to just say that conversion and repentance is a lifelong process of recognizing the ego for what it is, and I think it needs to happen daily and multiple times a day. I think the monastic communities, there was a reason why they had prayer three times a day. At least three times a day, stop everything, pause, pray, and come home. You've gone on a bunny trail for the last 3 hours, it's time to stop and realize who you are as a created child of God. I'm going to tell a little bit of something about my story growing up. I better keep this quick. as a very young person, I think even in the sixth grade, I had a deep desire in my heart to be a missionary in Northern Ontario. I don't know why Northern Ontario, but that's where I wanted to go. And anytime there was a story about, you know, the work that Christians were doing in Northern Ontario, I would perk up my ears, and this dream kind of just slowly developed. And, you know, the more I thought about it, it's like, yep, I want to be a bush pilot, volunteering for Northern Youth Programs, and I'm going to fly, you know, all over Northern Ontario. One of my freshman research papers was how to fly a single engine propeller plane. As a teenager, I spent many, many hours on a flight simulator, and learned how to fly a propeller plane on a flight simulator. Kind of getting into that junior and senior part of high school, I had made up my mind, nope, I'm not going to college, much to the chagrin of some of my high school teachers. And I was gonna, right out of high school, I was heading for Northern Ontario. That first summer out of high school, I really badly wanted to be a camp counselor, at a summer camp. And my parents said, well, how about you wait a year? So I dug in, worked hard for 1 year, and then I said, now's my chance. I'm going to Northern Youth Programs. So I spent the whole summer there. I thought surely that's going to be my segue into some kind of opportunity that's going to open up, and I'm going to just head over there for the rest of my life. But it didn't happen. Just through, I don't know, a course of events, it just seemed like I was knocking up against a block wall. Every time I tried, there was no opportunities popping up. I felt trapped in where I was at. And I just became very depressed and very frustrated as a young person. I was not doing well, and this was like when I was 19 years old. And I decided, well, you know what? This is getting so bad that I'm gonna commit like a whole winter at Bible school and get this figured out, because I really want to know what's going on. All my life, I thought of myself as a missionary in Northern Youth Programs, and why is this not working out? Went to Bible school, and just to make a long story short, one day I just kind of hit a ceiling, and I went to a little prayer room all by myself. And I kind of had that experience like Isaiah. I just let it go. I let go of my entire thought process that I'd had over the last 5 to 10 years. And it had consumed my thoughts. And I said, doesn't have to be me. It's okay. That's not me after all. And the minute I let that go, I felt a presence in the room that I can't describe. And so that was my most my most significant conversion experience because I knew that. I just knew in my bones who I was. It wasn't what I had said over and over in my head who I was, but I knew in my bones who I was. And that was only my first conversion because every day, every week, every year, I have to come back to that. You know, especially on a bad day. Things are just going crazy and my mind's spinning and I'm like trying to control what's going on and trying to think ahead on the next step and come back, come home. Your success or failure today does not make any difference about who you are. Just for one example. So back to Jesus' wisdom teachings. I'm just going to read some that just kind of strike me as things that if we could look at that and say, what is he speaking? What is he saying about our human condition, our human experience, that we can learn to be able to walk forward, recognizing this and also kind of living beyond it? First of all, I mentioned already, lose your life to find it. Jesus has so many stories and parables, which is his main way that he taught, and then through hands-on demonstrations about things that he did that meant things. He said, sell all you have and give to the poor. That was an instruction to a young man who was entirely attached in his mind to his possessions. And Jesus' words to him were, you don't have to be that. And he went away sad because he couldn't give that up. Jesus said, don't store up wealth or be anxious about future needs. You must be born again. He talked about treasure in a field and a pearl of great price. He talked about the gate being narrow the gate being narrow that leads to life. He said, don't work for food that perishes. Don't fast or give alms to be noticed by others. If your brother offends you, forgive 70 times 7. The first shall be last. Last shall be first. Masters are servants. Defilement comes from the inside, not the outside. Become like a child. God is a spirit. Those that worship him must worship in spirit and truth. John 15, he talks about you being in me and I in you. John 17, he prays for us that they may all be one as I and the Father are one. Jesus' words for the ego was simply hypocrite. Translated just simply means actor or imposter. So he had some harsh words for those that could not recognize the ego at work in their life, especially those that were in positions of cultural, religious, and political power, and that were living out of their false and separate self. When Jesus does oppose human sinfulness, it's the sins of malice with which he has no patience. The sins of weakness are always patiently healed. Jesus rightly accuses us religious folks of straining out gnats while swallowing camels. Jesus and the prophets deal with the root cause, which is always our radical egocentricity. Our problem is not an over-defended ego, which always sees, hates, and attacks its own faults in other people, and will go to all ends to avoid its own conversion. That's a quote from Richard Rohr, I believe, from his book Falling Upward. Following Jesus' spiritual teachings with spiritual disciplines and spiritual practices are directly related to becoming aware of and exposing the ego's games so that we can live by the Spirit. It's about union and reunion and walking in the light, becoming like a child or unself-conscious. True religion reconnects. The word religion is religio, which is like ligament. So it's a connective tissue. True religion reconnects us with our true identity. Unfortunately, many and possibly most religious people don't see it this way, and instead we use religion to bolster our egos and confirm our inner narrative and accentuate our separateness. So I guess one just parting word of encouragement is that, you know, we're all in the same experience in this way. We each have different personalities, but we all have kind of a similar thing that we're dealing with in terms of if we want to listen to the Spirit, these other voices have to die down. And so I titled the sermon, The Names We Give Ourselves, because the names we not only are we giving ourselves names, we're doing it all day long. And if we don't have a way to quiet that down through spiritual practices like solitude, like daily Bible reading or prayer, different ones of you have different ways to do it. I really like to just sit by myself in quiet for a while before I start the day. These are routines that help us detach from those identities that we work so hard to build and instead attach to, like, our true source and our createdness as children of God. Routinely bring the ego into the light so the Spirit can be heard and not quenched. And notice the nearness of the breath of God. And then one other source that I want to point to is I read a book that just kind of did a survey of all, like, a bunch of Christian mystics over the couple thousand years of Christian history. And I was so inspired by that because these folks were ones that really wanted to understand these things. And I think one of the standouts for me was Meister Eckhart, because he talks a lot about detachment and how that's so important for spiritual transformation. So thank you all for your time. Hope this was encouraging.